Most of it's quite straightforward, really.
So you've got, let's look at the Pali first, Supatipanno, Bhagavato Savaka Sangho. Then you've got Ujjipatipanno, Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, Nyayapatipanno, Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, and Samichi Patipanno, Bhagavato Savaka Sangho. So let's take Savaka Sangho first. Sangho is just a declension of Sangha. So it's, you know, in Pali, in certain ways, sometimes they say Sangho instead of Sangha, but it's exactly the same word. And Sangha simply means community or collection of people. It's a very, very simple word. When used in Buddhism, it's used in a very particular way. It's the Sangha of followers of the Buddha. But it actually just means community or collection of people. Savaka. I think we've come across this word before in the Tiratnavandana, haven't we? Savaka. Anybody know what savaka means? No? Okay, well, savaka comes from the word sutta. You might not believe this, but it does. It comes from the word sutta, which means to listen or to hear, as in the first level of wisdom, sutta maya panya. And savaka is a hearer. Or a listener. I'm sure you all know that when the Buddha was teaching, nothing was ever written down, so nobody ever read any texts. There were no texts. So all the teachings were done orally, verbally. So if you were a listener, if you listened, it meant that you were someone who listened specifically to the Dharma. So sometimes savaka is translated literally as hearer or listener. And but more often it's translated as disciple, because if you're a listener to the Buddha, it means you're a disciple of the Buddha, you're a follower, or you could even say a student of the Buddha. You're a student Buddhist. So savaka is a listener of the Buddha. And here we've got Savaka Sangho, which is the Sangha of those who listen to the Buddha. So that's what we are, really. We're the Savaka Sangho. We're the community of people who listen to the Buddha's teachings. And listen, I think I've said this before a couple of times in this class, but listen, sutta, if you look up in the Pali English Dictionary, the first meaning of listen is simply that, in a very simple sense, to hear or to listen. But it has a very specialised meaning of to listen to the truth, to listen to insight. Bhagavato. We've had this before. Anybody remember what Bhagavato means? Okay, so Bhagavato is a term very often applied to the Buddha, and it's quite an emotional term. It's a very devotional term to the Buddha. Sangrakshita translates it as you can see here, the richly endowed one. But often it's translated simply as the Lord. If you read any of the ancient Buddhist texts and you see someone referring to the Buddha as the Lord, the word will be Bhagava. So, that's the Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, which happens three times. So let's look at the first words of those lines then. Supatipanno. So, patipanno, Sangrakshita translates as proceeding. But I looked it up in the Pali English Dictionary, and its first meaning is practicing. Practicing. And I'm going to say a bit more about that in a moment. And if I forget, if I move on without having said any more about it, can you remind me? Because it's quite important what I want to say. But even when I remind myself there's something important I want to say, I often do forget when I'm giving a talk. So if you can remind me. This is very significant, I think. So, Sangrakshita has happily proceeding. It's the fellowship of hearers of the richly endowed one. Happily proceeding. So, su means happy. It also means well. So, if you're doing something and you do it su, you do it really well. And it also means thoroughly. So, you can take your pick, really. Happily, thoroughly, or well. Yeah. So if we take the word patipanno as practice, we could say happily practicing. We're happily practicing. Now, of course, you can't make yourself happy. You can't just decide, yeah, I'm going to practice happily. But that is something that we can aspire to. And I think as you deepen in your faith, as you practice more and your faith deepens, I think it's true to say that you do become happier as you practice. And even though you might be having a really tough time sometimes, you're just happily practicing the Dharma. You're just getting on with it quite happily. I think that's a really nice quality to bear in mind, isn't it? Or you could say well practicing, or practicing well, or practicing thoroughly. I'll say a little bit more about practicing thoroughly in a moment. So that's the first quality of the Sangha, that they're happily practicing, or they're well or thoroughly practicing the Dharma. So the second quality is ujjupatipanno. Uju. Anybody been here when I've talked about uju before? Because uju is probably my favourite Pali word. Simple word, three letters, U-J-U, uju. It's a wonderful word. It means the shaft of an arrow. So what's the characteristic of a shaft of an arrow? Straight, yeah. So it simply means straight. It's as simple as that. It's straight. And it's used a number of times in various Buddhist texts. In the Metta Sutta, for instance, it's one of the 15 qualities that you need to develop in order to develop metta. Uju. You need to develop uju, which is a kind of straightforwardness, a directness. In fact, in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha says uju, and then he says suju. Su, uju. So you know what su means now. Really straight. He says you need to be straightforward, and then he says you need to be really straightforward. And there's another text I've been looking at recently where a guy called Nigrodha is boasting to various people that when he meets the Buddha, he's going to baffle him and knock him over like an empty pot. So the Buddha hears about this, so he goes out of his way to meet this man, Nigrodha. And you can imagine what happens. They get into conversation, and Nigrodha fails to baffle the Buddha, and he fails to knock him over like an empty pot. In fact, he begins to look like a bit of a nit, really. He can't really keep his end up with the Buddha. So after a while, he's really struggling, and he eventually confesses. He says to the Buddha, look, the reason I wanted to meet you was not so I could really learn from you, it's so that I could make you look like a ninny. And now you're making me look like a ninny. And so the Buddha accepts his apology, and then he says something very interesting, and I think I can remember it word by word because it's so striking. He says, but I tell you this, Nigrodha, let someone come to me who is intelligent, straightforward, honest, and not deceitful, and I will instruct them in the Dhamma. That's the words he uses. And the second word he uses is uju jataka, which means uju, we know. I'm just trying to remember what jataka means now. Holding, a kind of a holding straightness, holding straightforwardness. So if you want to be a disciple of the Buddha, one of the things that we have to develop is a kind of straightforwardness and honesty and openness in our dealings with our teachers, but also with other members of the Sangha. So uju, straightforward. Sometimes uju is translated as upright, and you can see that Sangharaksha is translated upright, so he's taken it as a kind of moral quality, and sometimes it is translated like that, morally upright. But you could just as easily say it's a kind of straightforwardness in communication. You know, you're not beating about the bush. You could also say that uju is not really to do with how you relate to other people, but it's the fact that you're practicing straight. Yeah. What does that mean? You're practicing so you can get to enlightenment in the straightest possible route, the most direct possible route. So you're really practicing So you just go like that rather than going all over the place, as many of us do in our practice. Eventually we get there, but we sort of take many detours around the place, but straightforward. Then you've got Nyaya Patipanno, and Sangharakshita here has methodically proceeding. Nyaya means method, truth and system. And later it was Nyaya later becomes Buddhist logic, so it's this kind of method or system. But you could say methodically. Sangharakshita has methodically. So what does that mean, methodically? I was thinking a little bit about this earlier. I wonder how methodical we are in our practice. Or are we just a bit haphazard and slapdash? We just sort of practice a bit here and a bit there, and we don't quite know why we're doing this particular meditation practice, but we just do it. But methodically practicing suggests a kind of path, doesn't it? One step leading to another. And Buddhism is often taught as a graduated path. One step leading to the next, and so on. You've got, for instance, ethics, meditation and wisdom. That's a methodical way of practicing. First you practice ethics, and you might spend many months and years practicing ethics and even perfecting, you could say, ethics. And then that puts you in the state of mind where you can meditate. And then you meditate for a long time. And then that allows you, that prepares your mind for the receiving of wisdom. So that's one methodical thing. But even you could look at it a bit more closely than that. And let's say you do the mindfulness of breathing every other day. And then every other day you do the metta bhavana. That's the ideal, isn't it, to do them like that. Probably not many of us actually do them exactly like that. But let's say you do the mindfulness of breathing 3 or 4 times a week. And let's say you have a bit of trouble with the third stage. You're okay with the 2 counting stages, and you quite like the bit where you're focusing around the end of the nose or whatever you focus on. But in the third stage, you get a bit spaced out. You go all over the place. And that actually makes it very difficult to get to the fourth stage, doesn't it, if you space out a bit in the third stage. So if you were to methodically practice the mindfulness of breathing, what you would do is you'd notice that. You'd notice it in the third stage, you nearly always space out. And then you'd reflect on it. How come that happens? Why do I get spaced out when that happens? You'd find out why it was that you spaced out, and then you would apply some kind of antidote to that. Do you see what I mean? So this kind of methodically proceeding, sort of just step by step by step, and when you trip over with one step, you find out why you trip over there. And then you keep coming back to it, you find out, and then you practice again and you try different things. So that's methodically proceeding. And confession here, I must say I'm not very methodical in my practice. I just sort of get on with it in a kind of slapdash kind of way and hope for the best. But when I have occasionally applied method to my practice, I have found it really, really beneficial. So that's something I think we can think about, methodically proceeding. And then we've got Samichi Patipanno. And Samichi means right or proper. And what's Sangharakshita got? Correctly proceeding. So, good night, Douglas.
Yeah.
We'll see you in 2 weeks' time, is it? Okay. Have a good retreat. So correctly proceeding. I suppose that goes along with quite a lot of other things that I've been talking about, sort of just correctly practicing. But time's getting on, and I want to talk about this thing of practicing and the important thing that I wanted to say. It's mentioned 4 times, isn't it? Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Nyayapatipanno, and Samichipatipanno. And I think that's very significant, that in the Sangha Vandana, practice is mentioned 4 times. And I was thinking of an episode where Ananda, the Buddha's close friend, had heard that another teacher of another, you know, spiritual tradition had died sometime previously. And he'd heard that his community of disciples had kind of broken up. They hadn't managed to stay together as a Sangha. And he mentioned this to the Buddha. And he was a bit worried about the future of the Buddha's Sangha, the Savaka Sangho. How would we, you know, carry on? And the Buddha said, as long as people were practicing, then the Sangha would carry on. So I think this is very significant. What is it that makes us a Sangha? I suppose there are many things, aren't there, that make us a Sangha. The fact that we are hearers, listeners, disciples of the Buddha. We've got that in common. We hold certain ideas in common. Conditioned co-production. All compounded things are impermanent, etc., etc., etc. But perhaps the most important thing that binds us together is practice, the fact that we're practicing together. That's why it's always good, no matter what we're going to do on a Sangha night, is that we do some practice together. Usually meditation, isn't it? Actually, we're practicing as we sit here, me talking and you listening. This is another practice of the Sangha, isn't it? So that's what keeps us together, the fact that we're practicing. So that's the important thing I wanted to say. Now that next thing is a weird thing. It's a bit technical. Namely, these four pairs of individuals, these eight persons. So this takes a little bit of explaining, and I'm not sure how far to go into this, how much you want to know. You can tell me as I go into it. You might, at a certain point, you might go, whoa, that's enough. It's quite important in a way, but it's not important that we know the details of it. So who are these four pairs of individuals, these eight persons? Okay. So in early Buddhism, you've got this idea of practice, and then you've got this idea that practice leads to certain stages of insight. So what we're all aiming for is wisdom, isn't it? That's what we're really aiming for as Buddhist practitioners. Wisdom being insight into the nature of things. And in early Buddhism, you've got four stages of this, four deepening stages of insight into the nature of things. The first one is what's called stream entry. And when you have an insight experience strong enough to make you a stream entrant, what that means is you enter into the stream which takes you to enlightenment. Yeah? And what that suggests is that it becomes easier then. Practice becomes easier because you're going along with the stream. And I'm sure you've had this experience many times, that when you're practicing, sometimes it feels like you're trying to swim upstream against the current. Have you ever tried to do that in a river, swim against the current? I did it once. I was just as exercise, and it really took a lot of effort just to stay where I was, not to go downstream. So sometimes it feels like that, doesn't it, as we're practicing? It feels like we're going against the grain, we're going against the current, and it's really hard work. It's not always like that, but sometimes it is. When you become a stream entrant, practice becomes easy. So just from that point of view alone, it's worth striving for. You still have to strive as a stream entrant, but the difference between our striving and a stream entrant striving is a stream entrant striving is easy striving. It's a bit like they've entered into the zone and it becomes very easy. Yeah. There's a bit more to say about this stream entry, and I'll say a bit more about stream entry, because in a way stream entry is the most important goal that we could aim for. In the long term, we're all aiming for enlightenment. How many of you think you're going to gain enlightenment in this life? Well, that's quite something, isn't it? None of us put our hands up. Okay, but stream entry is something that each one of us can gain in this life if we put enough effort in, yeah? So what is it? When you become a stream entrant, or you become a stream entrant by breaking the first three of 10 fetters or chains that are binding you to the world, binding you to your the way you are, keeping you as you are. Yeah. You know that in that Buddhism is really about change. And
And lists.
It is about changing lists. Actually, you could say that, couldn't you? Two words for Buddhism: change and lists. So the first three fetters are, the first one is self-view, the idea that you have a fixed kind of core of your being which cannot really change. You might be able to change certain aspects of yourself, but deep down you cannot be changed. Self-view, yeah? So that is a fetter. While you hold that idea that deep down you can't really change, that is self-fulfilling. You're not really going to change very much. So you really need to take on board the fact that you can change completely and thoroughly. Yep. Right through, the whole of your being can change. That's the first fetter, the idea that somehow a part of you cannot really change. And you might believe this intellectually that you can change, but sometimes we give ourselves away. You know, when you've got a habit that you have not been able to break, or that you don't want to break, and somebody mentions it to you, and sometimes it happens quite often, doesn't it? Somebody, they keep talking to you, and eventually you go, well, this is just me. Yeah. You know, when you're a bit fed up with being criticised, this is just me, you're going to have to accept me as I am. That is an expression of self-view, that somehow I cannot change an aspect of myself. So that needs to go. The second feta is technically it's called dependence upon rites and rituals as ends in themselves. But really what it means, in our terms, is that you're practicing the Dharma. And when you started practicing the Dharma, you had this idea of change. You really had it, you really got it, you really understood it, and you were inspired by it. Now, a few years later, you're practicing because you're a Buddhist, but you've kind of forgotten that the reason you're practicing is so that you can change. Yeah? So you're no longer practicing so that you can change, you're practicing because you're a Buddhist. Can you see the difference there? So we need to keep coming back to this idea of change, that you can change. And the reason you're practicing is to allow that to happen, allow change to happen. And it's possible to take the Dharma and use it so that it prevents you from changing. You need to be very, very careful of this little trap, big trap, that you're practicing and it's keeping you the way you are rather than helping you to change. So you need to be very careful of that little trap. And the third fetter is doubt. Not that honest kind of questioning doubt that which we always encourage. You know, ask questions, disagree, it's fine to disagree. Really try to understand things. Second level of wisdom, thinking things through for yourself. Really try to think things through. And if you don't agree with something, you don't have to believe it. Okay? So it's not that kind of doubt, it's another kind of doubt. This is the kind of doubt where actually you think it probably is true, a certain teaching is true, but you don't like it. Yeah, it frightens you. It calls too much of you. And so you rationalise your fear and dislike of that teaching by coming up with kind of bogus problems about it. Oh, but if that were true, blah, 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 blah. One of the funniest ones was I was talking about chastity, celibacy, the fact that some people take up the practice of chastity as an aid to practice, and then somebody said, yeah, but if everyone did that, there'd be no children. True, but it's very unlikely everyone's going to do it for a start. But, you know, those are the kind of things that we can throw up in order to prevent ourselves from really looking at something. So those are the first three fetters. Self-view, the idea that somehow you're fixed. You are who you are and that's it. You can't really change. Second one, allied to that, very closely allied to that, is the idea that that you're practicing not so that you can change. Yeah, so that's the practical aspect of self-view, really. And the third one is throwing up problems with the teaching that aren't real problems, but they're throwing up smoke screens so that you won't really have to take them on board. When you become a stream entrant, those just go. You've broken those particular fetters. So this is important, and I'll talk about the importance in a moment. But then the next. Now, let's have a show of hands. Do you want me to go into some detail into the next stages, or is that enough for one evening? Show of hands if you want me to go into detail. Okay, that was the question was wrong, wasn't it? Thank you. Okay, that's enough, isn't it? We'll go into detail. Okay, so the second level. Ah, and by the way, you have to believe in rebirth for this to make any sense. But once you become a stream entrant, you only have 7 lives before you become enlightened. At the most, 7 lives. Once you become a stream entrant, you could still gain enlightenment in that life, so it's only 1 life, but at the very most. So even if you resisted the teaching and tried to get away from it for the next 7 lives, it's so much part of you now that you can't help it. You just keep on practicing, and eventually you gain enlightenment. Interestingly, Sangharakshita once said that it might be that we're all stream entrants. This is our 3rd or 4th life, maybe. And we can't remember. But the reason we've come back to the Dharma, or even we've come to the Dharma, maybe we've come back to the Dharma. And this is one of our lives as a stream entrant. That's quite an interesting idea, isn't it? Okay, so next stage is the stage of the once returner. The once returner. And we're back to lives here, lifetimes. The once returner only has 1 life left. Yeah, then they're going to gain enlightenment in their next life when they return, their once return. And they weaken the next 2 fetters. And the next 2 fetters are sensual desire and ill will. Sense desire and hatred. So I always find this very encouraging, that you can become the stream entrant, but you've still got sense desires and ill will. I find that very, very comforting, the idea that, you know, one can become a stream entrant before you break those fetters. I have my own reasons for finding that comforting, but... The once returner weakens them. So even the once returner, someone who's going to gain enlightenment in the next life, only weakens those 2 fetters. They still got them to a certain extent. And then the next is the non-returner. The non-returner is someone who is going to gain enlightenment either in this life or in the pure abodes. The pure abodes are a kind of heaven world where beings who are going to gain enlightenment soon dwell. This is all, some of you might find this all a bit crazy, but don't worry about it. It's all just part of the early Buddhist tradition. But they break the 4th and 5th fetters, ill will and sense desire. So they're broken completely. So it might be worth, because this is all a bit technical, but let's just spend a little bit of time using our imagination here. Just imagine what it would be like to be a person who doesn't suffer from the mental states of sense desire. I say suffer from them. How many of you think that mental states of sense desire are suffering? Are states of suffering? Okay. So let's rephrase that then. Wanting things, desiring things. That's kind of wanting thing. Sometimes I say that human beings are wanting creatures. It's one of the things that set us, that are characteristics of a human being is they want. Yeah, it's that kind of wanting after, hankering after things. So imagine living without that. Put positively, that means complete and utter contentment. Deep contentment. Can you imagine living like that? That'd be quite wonderful, wouldn't it? And no ill will whatsoever. No one would ever get on your nerves. Yeah? Can you imagine that?
No.
It's quite hard to imagine that, isn't it? No one would get on your nerves. You would never feel any kind of... Of course, these two are the two great trying to think of a word other than thing, let's just say thing for now, that we experience in life. Wanting and not wanting. Yeah, pulling towards oneself and pushing away. And this is how we live all through our lives. Want that, don't want that. Like this.
Yeah, desire for enlightenment.
Ah.
So part of the journey.
That's true, that's true. But imagine living without that kind of, oh, I want this, I want this, I don't want that. Complete contentment. Okay, so Jill brought up an interesting thing about that, that there is some kind of desire for enlightenment. I'm not going to try to answer that right now, but there's something we can talk about later when we come back together. It's now 25 to 9. I've been going on for some time, haven't I? So I'm going to try and wrap this up very soon now. The next stage is enlightenment, full enlightenment. And then the next stage is then you break the next five fetters all in one go. All in one go. So what are they? I can never remember them because they're so far away that I don't find that I really need to remember them at the moment. But I did write them down today. The first one is desire for rebirth in the Kama Loka, which is the world here. So the desire to come back to this world. Then the next one is desire for rebirth in the Arupa Loka, and the Rupa Loka, the realms of the gods, to come back in a godlike realm. So you could say that that's the desire to live in heaven in your next life. Then the next one you might find a bit strange, but it's restlessness. Funny that, isn't it? You'd think that you'd have got rid of restlessness way, way, way before. But this doesn't mean that sort of simple restlessness when you're trying to meditate and you can't quite get down to it. It's a kind of deep restlessness deep inside yourself. A kind of state where you're not completely and utterly here and present. And then ignorance, of course, the fetter, the chain of ignorance is broken. And then finally, conceit. Conceit. And Sangharakshita has said that probably what this means is that by now, at this point in your spiritual life, you'd probably be quite well known as a teacher. And this can be quite dangerous when you're well known as a teacher, because then you start thinking, oh, I'm doing well. And you start enjoying the work, being well known and even a bit famous. And then that can become a real fetter to your further growth. So it's when you start doing well and people start looking up to you and, you know, maybe you've written a book and you're a bestseller and you start really getting loads of people coming to your events and so on. That's when it becomes dangerous. Yeah. Okay. So, got quite a lot to go yet, so I'm going to have to go quite quickly through the next little bit. Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, so we've got this Bhagavato Savaka Sangho again. This, Esa is this. Ahuneyo, Pahuneyo, Dakineyo, Anjalakarineyo. So let's just very briefly look at those words now. So, ahuneyo means worthy of offerings, venerable, adorable, worshipful. So the Sangha is all those things. Pahuneyo. members of the Sangha are worthy of hospitality. So, you know, they're deserving to be a guest. You know, the art of hospitality is a wonderful thing, isn't it? When you go somewhere and stay with some people and they really look after you, it's such a fantastic experience, isn't it? So that's something that we really, you know, need to do as Buddhists. We need to really look at the art of hospitality and making people feel welcome, particularly other members of the Sangha. Dakinneya. Members of the Sangha are worthy of gifts and donations, so it's worth giving to them. And then Anjali Kawinio. So Anjali is this. It's this gesture. It's putting the hands together like this. That's the Anjali gesture, the Anjali Mudra, as it's called. So it's simply that. So it's a token of reverence. So members of the Sangha, this is how you approach them. Anjali Kawinia. So Kawinia means that ought to be or must or should be done, to be done. So this is how you should approach other members of the Sangha. With that, even if you don't do this literally, put your hands together literally, it's that kind of gesture. Then what have we got? Anuttarang. Uttara means higher, high, superior. And an uttara means without a superior. So unrivaled, unparalleled. And then we've got punya ketang. Ketang comes from the word ketang, which means dwelling place or field. And punya means merit. Meritorious action, virtue. So members of the Sangha are fields of merit. Punya Keta, or the whole Sangha is a field of merit. And then finally, Loka Sati. Sangha Ajta has an incomparable source of goodness to the world. Incomparable source of goodness. Source of goodness is his translation of Punya Keta. To the world, Loka. So I think that will do. And then we've got the other part of the Sangha Vandana, which is in common with the other parts of the Tiratna Vandana. All my life I go for refuge to the fellowship. Fellowship is Sangha Ajta's translation of Sangha there, which is a bit weird, isn't it, fellowship? What do you think of that word, fellowship? I think we know what Sangha means, so we could just say, all my life I go for refuge to the Sangha. But here, when we say I go for refuge to the Sangha, we need to bear in mind two meanings of Sangha. There's the Arya Sangha and there's the Maha Sangha. The Maha Sangha is the whole of the Buddhist world, really. Everyone who considered themselves to be a Buddhist, including us. The Arya Sangha is the Sangha that we go for refuge to. The Arya Sangha, Arya literally means noble, but it means transcendental. So it's the transcendental Sangha. In other words, the stream entrants, the once returners, the non-returners, and the arahants. Those have got insight. They're the ones we go for refuge to. Why do we go for refuge to them? Because they've got insight, because they've got wisdom. And if you, the thing about refuges is that what the Buddha used to say was, you could go for refuge to anything. But the trouble is, lots of things out there are unreliable. You know, they cannot hold your refuge. The three jewels are reliable. They can hold your refuge. But it's the Arya Sangha that we go for refuge to because they're reliable. Once you've gained insight, deep insight, and become a stream entrant, you won't fall back from the path. That means we can rely on these people, not only for their wisdom, but also for their constancy, the fact that they will always be there and they'll always be practicing. So that's the Sangha that we go for refuge to. To all the Sanghas of the past, to all the Sanghas yet to be, or all future Sanghas, to all Sanghas that are Sanghas that exist now. My worship flows unceasingly. no other refuge than the Sangha. Refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. So that's the Sangha Vandana. One last thing I'd like to say about it is that it's looking at the Sangha from a particular point of view, the point of view of practice and stages on the path. It doesn't really address the issue of Sangha as practice. What I mean by that is Sangha as practice rather than meditation as practice or ethics as practice. In other words, it doesn't really touch upon the issue of relationships within the Sangha. And that is what we're really going to be concentrating on the next 5 weeks. Sangha as practice, the fact that we can actually, in our relationships with one another, that can actually be a very definite and powerful aspect of our practice. And that's what we're going to look at over the next 5 weeks.